From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
The sound of mourning, the deaths of four more youths in Palestine. This time, four young men killed by Israeli forces in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank were memorialized this past weekend. Press TV's Marzi Hashemi has more.
Funeral processions were held for 19-year-old Nasser Abu Taib, 23-year-old Ziad Agla, and 22-year-old Ahmed Abu Labda in Khan Yunis in the southern Gaza Strip. The victims were among the five protesters shot dead in the latest demo from the Great Return March weekly protest. Nearly 100 people were also wounded in the Israeli crackdown. Another funeral was held in Ramallah for a Palestinian man who was killed during clashes with Israeli forces on Friday. The 33-year-old victim, called Othman Ladawa, was shot in the back. Nine others also sustained injuries in Ramallah clashes, and one of them is in critical condition. You're joined by Mr. Mick Nepias from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign. Thanks so much for being with us. I mean, the situation seems to deteriorate each week. We have at least 100 people who were injured yesterday, at least four who were killed, and basically, once again, unfortunately, nothing is being said by so much of the Western media. Tell me your take on all of this. Again, we talk about this all the time, but we're trying to get to some type of conclusion. What needs to happen? What needs to happen in order for the death and the lives of Palestinians to get the appropriate attention in order to change the status quo?
I mean, it took massacres in South Africa. 69 people massacred in a famous incident in Sharpeville, 200 to 500, we don't know, killed in a later massacre in Soweto. Before South Africa, apartheid South Africa, was expelled from the Olympic Games, began to have economic sanctions, arms embargoes, even from the Americans and the British, leveled against it for those massacres. We need something similar, and we are nowhere near getting them. So the struggle of the Palestinians is incredibly inspiring. The disparity in power, the determination of the Palestinians to demand their rights, the rights that were recognized by the United Nations as a precondition for even recognizing the state of Israel. Palestinians are demanding that that right of return be acknowledged. They're not going to give it up.
Last week, Michael Link, the special rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories, occupied since 1967, presented a report to the General Assembly. On Friday, he held a press conference at the UN in New York.
Well, good afternoon. The press conference now will be on the issue of the Palestinian territories, and we have with us the special rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories, Mr. Michael Link. He will make some opening remarks, and then we'll take some questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the introduction. In its most recent report on the occupied Palestinian territory, the World Bank described Gaza's economy as being in free fall. This term actually aptly applies to the entire situation in Gaza. It's already anemic economy, contracted by a minus 6% growth rate during the first quarter of 2018. Its disastrous unemployment rate has reached 53%, with youth unemployment over 70% now. Palestinians living in Gaza have access to no more than 5 hours of electricity a day. The coastal aquifer, which supplies most of Gaza's drinking water, is 97% contaminated by seawater and sewage. The main economic crossing between Gaza and Israel at Kerem Shalom has largely been closed in the past several months. Basic health services are collapsing. the drastic cuts in international aid to the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, and salary cuts initiated by the Palestinian Authority has disproportionately hit the 70% of Palestinians in Gaza who are refugees, its largest and most vulnerable population. The United Nations stated in 2012 that Gaza may well be unlivable by 2020. I submit to you that when electricity has been cut to 5 hours a day, when safe drinking water has almost disappeared, and when its economy is cratering before our eyes, then the state of unlivability is already upon us. And the international community must insist that all parties, and particularly Israel, the occupying power, bring immediate end to this disaster. These dire conditions explain much about the impetus for the large-scale demonstrations that the world has witnessed over the last 7 months at the Gaza frontier. In the context of these demonstrations, over 200 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli security forces, including as many as 40 children, and almost 23,000 Palestinians have been injured, with half of them requiring hospitalization in the already overcrowded and under-resourced Gaza health centers. The Special Rapporteur joins many others in the human rights community in insisting that Israel must comply with the basic principles on the use of force, which stipulate that weapons and lethal force can only be used as a last resort and only in cases of imminent threat to death or serious injury. At the very least, a significant majority of these deaths and injuries do not appear to have satisfied this strict criterion. The Special Rapporteur, therefore, welcomes the creation by the Human Rights Council of the International Commission of Inquiry into the events in Gaza and wishes it well in its investigation into these deaths and injuries and whether the occupying power has been acting in accordance with international law. Regarding the West Bank and annexation, let me point out that the Israeli settlements are a grave breach of international law, and civilian settlements in occupied territories constitute a war crime under the Rome Statute. Similarly, the annexation of territory is strictly forbidden. In years past, Israel has formally annexed East Jerusalem and the Syrian Golan Heights, a move that has not been recognized by the international community and has been sharply condemned, but which Israel has neither relinquished or undone. Today, we are witnessing strenuous efforts by the occupying power to entrench its claim over all or much of the West Bank in a number of developments which I constitute as soft annexation moves. The Israeli Knesset has adopted a number of laws in the past year which have become a flashing green light for more formal annexation steps. The Settlement Regularization Law, enacted in 2017, allows for the retroactive legalization of settlement outposts in the West Bank that have been built on private Palestinian land. The Jewish Nation-State Law is a quasi-constitutional basic law, which provides in Article 7 that, and here I quote, "The state views the development of Jewish settlements as a national value and will act to encourage and promote its establishment and consolidation," unquote. Other recent legislation has extended Israeli laws to the West Bank settlements in violation of international humanitarian law. For the past 50 years, the international community has been playing checkers while Israel has been playing chess. A deep-rooted problem at the heart of this conflict has not been the clarity of international law. In fact, it is quite clear, but rather the unwillingness of the international community to enforce what it has proclaimed. In this situation, international accountability is both a responsibility and a necessity. Only with decisive action by the United Nations and the international community insisting that Israel must either fully annul its annexations and relinquish its occupation, or be prepared to bear the full consequences of international accountability, will we start moving towards a compassionate peace in the Middle East. Thank you. Those are my opening remarks.
Thank you very much. Questions? Yes, please. Could you identify your news media, please?
Yes, I'm Rhonda Halbin, and I write for a blog that cuts the feet of the Zaytun called Netizen Blog. And I want to also welcome you, Michael. Link is having you seen me?
Yes, it is.
To the UN, and thank you for giving this press conference.
Thank you. for that.
I have a question about, it just seems that last year you did something about the weakness of understanding of occupation, where the Geneva Accords and the other laws, international laws, basically provide for an occupation that's short, that's, you know, that does a number of things, and you spelled those out. And I thought you did something very important in helping to people to understand what is international law and how what's happened with the occupation in general is outside of international law, really. And now you're saying that international law here is clear, and yet it's not being, there's nothing being done about it. So that's similar. That's
similar. Talk to the mic.
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you.
It's on. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So last year you did something similar, but and then with this year is a little different. I thought last year was very helpful because I thought the understanding of international law is not very clear in general, and I think here I haven't seen it very strong either. But my question is. What's the connection, do you see, between what you did last year and what you're doing this year? And with checkers and chess, as your analogy, which is very helpful when two sides are dealing with it at a very different level, how does it get dealt with so that, in fact, the sides are dealt with in an appropriate way? And I don't find that here. It just seems that the two sides are treated as equal, and in fact, the strength of the two sides, etc., and the law involved in none of that's equal, and that has to be understood. But I think it's not. So I think what you're doing is very helpful. But do you have any sense from what happened, what you did last year and this year? Is there a way that there has to be more understanding among and etc.?
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you for that question, and thank you for referring to my report from last October as well. That report dealt with whether Israel remains the lawful occupant of the Palestinian territories, and I laid out a legal analysis, and I laid out, I guess, a policy analysis, and I said that the laws of occupation are quite strict. They require that occupations be temporary, that there be no annexation or sovereignty claim on the territory by the occupying power, that the occupying power act in good faith and act as a trustee towards the best interests of the people under occupation. And I compared that with Israeli actions over the last 50 years of the occupation and found that Israel's actions have been wanting with respect to that. So what I did was I called on the United Nations to want to either commission a legal study into this issue of whether Israel is still the lawful occupant. Remember, this occupation has gone on for 5 decades. Most occupations in the modern world, when you think of the United States in Iraq, or the Americans in Japan, or the Western Allies in Germany after the Second World War, those occupations lasted no more than 10 years. So 50 years is an extraordinary and unique benchmark in modern international relations. I'm happy to report to you, in answer to your question, that there have been several conferences organized in the Middle East that I think my report played some role in choosing the themes of a prolonged occupation and whether or not it's still legal. I think these ideas are now circulating among civil society. They're circulating among legal scholars, and they're now also being considered by some states as well. So we'll see what happens if these ideas actually begin to ripen. But it's actually gratifying as a law professor and as a special rapporteur to see something that you've written actually beginning to have legs and being taken up seriously by people as a practical means of trying to find some just end that will bring us all to this compassionate peace that I'm talking about. My report this year, I think, is a companion piece, is on annexation. Annexation is strictly forbidden under the laws of occupation. And indeed, what some civil society activists and human rights defenders who pay attention to the Middle East conflict have talked about is they're now seeing how how occupation is actually being transformed into annexation. That they've come up with this new term called occu-annexation, which I think in many ways is a very apt descriptive term for the process that's occurring, particularly on the West Bank, where Israel is continuing to expand its settlement program. You can find quotations from many current Israeli cabinet ministers who are calling openly for annexation of West Bank settlements around Jerusalem, to attach them to Jerusalem, of parts or all of the Area C of the West Bank, or indeed of all of the West Bank. I think what Israel was doing in a much more covert and subtle way previously is now being done much more openly and, in fact, brazenly. And I think it's incumbent upon the international community to take those steps to remind Israel that it is not in compliance with international law, and that if it plans to live peacefully and in harmony with its Palestinian neighbors and allow them a genuine right of self-determination, it can't. That is impossible to do with the expansion of its settlement program and its annexation claims in the West Bank.
Yes, please.
Yeah, my name is Benny Avni. I'm with the New York Post, and I have two questions, actually. First one is, what do you make of this latest Human Rights Watch report on the Palestinian Authority and Hamas?
Yeah.
And the second has to do with this Canadian Dimitri Lankaris that you spent, that you shared a stage with recently, was condemned by a lot of Canadians, including Prime Minister Trudeau, as anti-Semitic. Would you condemn him as well?
With regards to your first question, and you're referring to a report released, I believe, yesterday by Human Rights Watch that was very critical of the human rights violations that they said had been committed by Hamas and by the Palestinian Authority. Look, I welcome the report. I have a high regard for the professional advocacy work of Human Rights Watch. I have not yet read the report. I've read summaries of it only, but the summaries that I've read are certainly disturbing, and I think they call for political and legal scrutiny of these apparent violations made by both the PA and Hamas. I believe, and I think this is probably true for all of my special rapporteur colleagues, that human rights are indivisible and they're interdependent. And when I talk to human rights organizations, Israeli and Palestinian, international, that pay attention to this, I discuss these issues of purported human rights violations committed by Palestinian institutions and government bodies with civil society. And I'm looking forward to be able to read the entire report with respect to this. I don't think that anybody or institution is that is capable of infringing the human rights of others should be immune from the scrutiny of human rights organizations and the application of human rights standards.
Have you ever included these kind of discussions that you describe in your reports?
No, and you'll probably know the answer for that, is that my current mandate focuses entirely on Israel as the occupying power. That's not my choice. If the Human Rights Council would agree to or chooses to expand the mandate of the Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in the Palestinian Territories, then I would obviously fulfill that particular mandate.
And as to
the second question?
Condemnation.
The statement, I think, made by the person that you're referring to was questioning the dual loyalty of the loyalty of a couple of several Canadian members of Parliament with respect to some of their statements on Israel and Canada. Those aren't statements that I would make, and those aren't statements that I would associate myself with.
Anti-Semitic?
Um, Actually, I've not considered that particular question, whether or not they're anti-Semitic. I just don't find them helpful in the dialogue of trying to figure out a way of getting a compassionate peace in the Middle East, and for trying to find dialogue between different communities as to trying to find ways of bridging their differences.
Thank you. Dulcie?
Yeah, thanks very much. Can you just go over what you said earlier about illegal occupation versus legal? Because I'm just a little confused.
Sure.
Thanks.
Okay, and actually I didn't use the term illegal occupation. What I talked about was Israel as the illegal occupant. This is a term that has been used previously in international law to describe, for example, South Africa's mandate over Namibia or Southwest Africa in the 1960s and 1970s. And it's a term I think is apt with respect to describing Israel's continuation of its occupation. If I can reiterate what I said before and reiterate a central component of the laws of occupation is meant to be temporary. Most modern occupations have been in the range of anywhere from 5 to 10 years. This is an occupation that is over 5 decades long. It's hard to find any good faith efforts by the occupying power to either comply with international law or to follow the directions of the international community. There have been there's been a score of resolutions passed by the Security Council directing Israel not to build settlements, not to continue with the separation wall, not to annex East Jerusalem or the Syrian Golan Heights. Those have not been complied with by the occupying power. Hundreds of resolutions to the same effect with respect to the General Assembly and the Human Rights Council. Israel has enough notice to know where it stands with respect to international law and the opinion of the international community, yet it continues to entrench, to deepen, to thicken its occupation. One can only conclude that it's doing so in order to be able to establish an annexation claim. And that's certainly true if you read any statements by any number of Israeli cabinet ministers or indeed the prime minister with respect to its intentions in at least parts of the West Bank. So that's why I say that I think at some point Israel has crossed the bright red line into illegality in its role as the occupying power.
Thank you. Are there further questions? Yes, please.
I wonder if you could give a little background about the Namibia-South Africa situation, because I thought the Security Council at some point helped with that.
And, yes. Yeah, it's a very good precedent for helping us to understand both the legal situation with respect to this ongoing occupation and what steps might be taken to try to bring the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territory to a successful conclusion. In the years immediately following the First World War, South Africa was given a mandate over the former German colony of Southwest Africa, which we now know as Namibia. And it was to rule that territory as a trustee in the best interests of the occupants, of the inhabitants of Southwest Africa, and to prepare that country and its people for independence and self-determination. When it became obvious to the international community beginning in the 1960s that South Africa was instead having annexationalist designs on Southwest Africa or Namibia and was indeed intending to annex it as the fifth province of South Africa, resolutions began to arise both in the General Assembly in the 1960s as well as the Security Council. And eventually Security Council in 1970 asked the International Court of Justice for a advisory opinion as to whether South Africa's continuing mandate over Southwest Africa was still lawful. Because there was no provision as to when a mandate may become illegal under the terms of the mandate provisions in the League of Nations. And the International Court of Justice delivered one of the most important decisions it's ever released in June or July of 1971, essentially ruling that agreeing with the Security Council and the General Assembly that South Africa did have annexationist designs on Southwest Africa. It was pursuing policies of discrimination. It was introducing apartheid to the area and ruled that South Africa now had become the illegal mandatory power or illegal occupant of Namibia. And I think that stands as an important precedent for the international community to consider when it turns its mind to whether or not Israel has now crossed the bright red line with respect to its continuation of its powers of occupation.
Thank you.
I wondered if anyone on the Security Council or if you've heard from them about wanting to know more of this background, because it just seems that the Security Council works on fairly limited knowledge, and I wondered about that.
Yeah. No, I haven't. But what I can say is that among international legal scholars who pay attention to the Middle East, among civil society organizations that work on human rights issues with respect to Israel and Palestine, the Namibia precedent is well known. It's being written about. It has been written about. It continues to be written about. And it's being used as a potential precedent, useful precedent, for how the international community can move forward on trying to find, a just resolution to the question of Palestine.
Thank you. Anything further? No. Oh, yes. All right, Rhonda.
And that was if you two parts to it. One, the question of what the conferences have taken up. Is there anything that you've seen there that's been really, interesting or worth sharing in a summary? And then the second part is, I thought the fact that somehow what I've seen here is a treatment of Israel and Palestine as equal and having equal, why don't they both negotiate, etc.? Yeah. And when I say, but that's not what can, that doesn't get, you can't see that as a way forward because they're not equal. Mm-hmm. Essentially, that doesn't even seem understood in general. So I'm wondering if you
sure.
see a need for more understanding and how to do that. So those two.
Okay. The first question you asked had to do with these two conferences that I mentioned. I was not physically at either conference. I delivered keynote addresses in both conferences through Skype. The second conference was in Ramallah, which I'm not allowed to go to. The Israeli government does not allow, give me permission to be able to enter into the occupied Palestinian territory, so I was not able to go. I do know, obviously, just by looking at the conference agenda, that there were a range of papers examining legality of the occupation, issues of annexation, issues of whether or not this has actually turned into a question of colonialism, and so on. So there was a rich interchange from what I could tell in terms of varying perspectives on how to describe the present occupation. On your second question, you're right, I'd missed that from before. You said to me that in the eyes of some, that Israel and Palestine are treated as having basically the same amount of power, and you're right to point that out. Certainly from the Special Rapporteur's perspective, one is an occupying power, one is an occupied people. There is an extraordinary difference in the levels of economy. One has the economy of a mid-level European power, the other is definitely a third world economy. In terms of the military, one is one of the very strongest military powers in the region and one of the strongest powers in the world, and the other is a little more than a police force with respect to this. So the powers that each of them have, at least talking on those particular terms, are quite unequal. If you look at the balance the other way, you might say that there is a great deal of both public and national sympathy for the plight of the Palestinians, and that's probably why the Palestinians, if they are unable to advance their agenda anywhere else and their cause, are able to get such large votes in the General Assembly, because I think they recognize that there is a fair amount of world opinion behind their genuine quest for self-determination.
Thank you.
Okay, last question,
Rhonda. That's all right.
Might it be possible to do a follow-up on your what's happened last time and to have access to some of those conference proceedings or just...
I'm happy to tell you who organized the conferences and to tell you where they're going. I'm at quite a physical distance from them, so I don't have a direct hand in that, but I'd be happy to point you that way.
Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.